Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Harriet F. Sini, and tonight we're talking about her book, Memorials to Shattered Myths, Vietnam to 9/11. Harriet, welcome back to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you again.
I'm so pleased to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Now, we had originally talked about Mount Rushmore and actually other monuments that are related to the people represented in Mount Rushmore. But this is a different book, and this actually puts that book in perspective. These are our national memorials, but it's there's a weird thing about what they commemorate or celebrate. You write that from the start, this genre of national memorials was problematic in the United States. Why?
Well, to begin with, we didn't have a tradition from which we could draw, right? If we think about memorials that existed when this country was formed, we've got memorials to kings, we've got memorials that honor the church, but none of those, you know, seem to make much sense here. And so we weren't really sure what they should look like. I mean, we did draw on some very traditional memorial forms, but when I look at some of them today, for example, the Washington Monument, how would we know it was Washington if it wasn't called that?
That's
it's
right.
A traditional form, a very heroic form, but, you know, Washington just seems to be tagged onto that.
What's fascinating about the memorials that you write about in this book? It's the Vietnam Veterans War Memorial is the one that begins it, but it's also the Federal Building in Oklahoma City, Columbine, and the World Trade Center. Their whole histories, and what I love about your book is you give the whole history about who came up with the design, how they built it, how it was changed. But in every case, these things are memorializing or commemorating controversial events. And let's start with talking about the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. People today, young people, don't understand how shattering that war was to the country. That split the country.
Absolutely. It split it apart like nothing had since the Civil War. And that rift, of course, as we know, has only become more threatening, if you will. I just want to back up for a minute and explain how I came to put these four, when you look at it at first, apparently unrelated events and memorials together, which is very personal in a way. My family were Holocaust survivors, not all of them, but my parents, fortunately. And so I grew up in a community of people who had survived the Holocaust, but who never presented as victims. And that was, you know, and then I'm looking at all these memorials going up to what seemed to me, in fact, are victims. And that's when I began thinking about what these four memorials and these four events that had national implications had in common. And so, you know, Vietnam was obviously a very obvious place to begin because of its role in the nation's history and also because of its placement on the National Mall between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial.
What's amazing, and let's begin talking a conversation about that, I can remember vividly all the controversy and the hue and cry about this memorial, first of all, the design was such a slam to the country, that even the choice of the granite, and you talk about this in the book, the fact that it was black granite means it was like negative. I remember racist comments about the designer and that was a slap in the face that they chose an Asian woman to represent our Asian war.
I think you're absolutely right about focusing. I mean, you cannot even imagine all the criticisms. First of all, that it wasn't white, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, and this seems like it would be, we've dealt with things a little bit better today, But you wouldn't believe the sort of crazy crap that was coming out of people's mouths. This is before it was built. This was just the design.
Just the design. I mean, it was really an incredibly toxic environment. And the designer, Maya Lin, was an architecture student at Yale at the time. And this had been an assignment in a class on funerary architecture in which, and I just have to say this because my students always loved it, she only got a B minus.
I know. You know what? I hope that grade was changed.
I would think so after the fact. And I believe that her professor had also entered the competition. So you can, anyway.
There may have been a couple of mea culpas after that. I hope so.
I would hope so.
She's a brilliant, and by the way, she's gone on to become an architect and a memorial designer. And what she, her view, and I love the way you write about this, is she wanted to design a reflective and contemplative memorial.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, what she said, I just happen to have the quote in front of me because I think it's so pertinent. She said, "For death is, in the end, a personal and private matter, and the area contained within this memorial is a quiet place meant for personal reflection and private reckoning," which is lovely, but keep in mind it's on the National Mall.
Yeah, and keep in mind the time. This is not that long after the Vietnam War was over.
Exactly.
And the hard feelings about that were still very much part of our national politic.
And one could argue continue to be.
Yeah.
But that's a different conversation.
That is a different conversation, but it's an important one. When you refer to this as the nation's first therapeutic memorial, and her hope was to help expressly to heal a collective psychological injury that the war had caused.
Yes, and Kirk Savage, who's written about this extensively, he first made that observation that it was the nation's first therapeutic memorial. And he also said, and this raises a very interesting question, that it was the Capitol's first victim monument. So since this book posits that all these memorials were memorials to victims, as well as other things, people who fight in wars are a certain kind of victims. I think that the way you can apply the victim memorial to Vietnam is to think that the people who fought were trapped in a very questionable war. Certainly, after the war, they were in some ways blamed for it, even though their behavior, their fighting, had been most part patriotic. So we get into a kind of complicated category. And just looking back for a minute, this notion of this private mourning place on the National Mall, that really conflates the functions of, say, a cemetery with a national memorial, a public memorial.
It's
interesting here.
Yeah. Let's just take a moment out and describe it because there may be people who have never been to the National Mall. It's horizontal. It's sort of like a very shallow V. It's below ground level. And that was an interesting choice because that sort of, as you write about in the book, suggests a kind of burial. And there's two 246 feet long tapering segments, 70 panels, and the names, and this was controversial. The names are arranged chronologically. What was Maya Lin's reason for that?
Yeah, chronologically in the order in which they died.
Yeah.
Because she thought if she listed them alphabetically, first of all, it makes the wall, it is commonly referred to as the wall because there are two walls that meet at the apex, which is higher in the center. It made it chronologically more of a historical statement, but more to the point, if she listed them alphabetically, like all the Smiths and the Jones would be together, and there are books at either end where you can look up names so you can find a specific name where, of course, they have to be listed alphabetically or how would you find them. You see what that would have done. It would have read like a phone book.
Yeah. And this way, veterans who have friends and close friends that died in an event that they were in, they're all together. All the people who died in a battle here or a battle there.
Exactly, and that makes it easier for their friends and families to gather, you know, on specific holidays or even, you know, sometimes personal ones. And it's really interesting, just that concept of listing groups together was what happened at the 9/11 memorial. I'm just going to mention this for a second, where people were listed according to where they worked.
Right.
For that same reason.
Now, there's always surprising elements in your work. I've only read two of your books, but there's always something that just surprises me. You write about the design's relationship to earthwork projects.
Right, because that's I'm an art historian, and I just need to interject a word here about how we refer to memorials.
Okay.
Memorials, to my mind, are works of art, and therefore they should be italicized the way we would a sculpture or a painting. It's architecture that's not italicized, but memorials are more than architecture, or their architecture, one could argue, with a specific purpose. So I and my frequent partner, Cher Knight, have started, both in our separate and books and our collaborations, to italicize the names of memorials, and I think I did it throughout this book. But looking at this memorial, it is built into the earth.
Yeah.
That, you know, and so that, of course, suggests a kind of burial. And the earthworks that had preceded this construction, this structure, were all about using the earth as a surface for works of art.
And the example you give is Klaus Oldenburg's Placid Civic Monument.
Right, which was part of an exhibition, Sculpture and Environment, in New York in, I think, 67 already. And it was dug sort of the size of a grave, not too far from the museum, the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I think Oldenburg said afterwards that a grave was a perfect kind of memorial.
Now, let's
talk. It was very, very strange to me to come across that.
Well, you also talk about the works of Richard Serra, and I actually see a relationship between her design and Richard Serra's work.
Yes, and she's acknowledged that connection quite frequently. Serra was teaching at Yale when she was a student there,
right.
So she certainly would have been aware of his work, and he had done a piece in St. Louis, where if you look at the separate segments, you could just imagine putting them together and getting a form that looked a lot like the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Harriet F. Senney. Tonight, we're talking about her book, which I strongly recommend, Memorials to Shattered Myths, Vietnam to 9/11. Harriet, let's talk about the controversy. And as a person who was in college at that time, I vividly remember this. And I didn't remember until I read it again in your book, H. Ross Perot was behind a lot of the controversy.
Yes, he was. And he really wanted to see a memorial built to the Vietnam vets who really, really got such a raw deal by this country on their return. I think he somewhat wanted to see that corrected. But then when he saw this design, he really wasn't so happy with it.
This design made people go apoplectic.
Yeah, it was as if it struck a national nerve among some people, right?
And everybody started wanting to add things to it.
Which, in fact, they did. And, you know, there's something I do want to say about the way we perceive that memorial. I was struck by it again when I visited it several times in the writing of this book. We now walk past the memorial. You start at one of the low ends, which is facing the Lincoln Memorial. Then you continue to walk into the center, at which point it's over your head. So arguably that already suggests a kind of entombment. And then you walk out the other end, and you're facing the Washington Monument. But when Maya Lin created this, that's not what she intended. She intended for you to come on it straight on across a lawn. But what happened were drainage issues, and the Park Service put in this path to walk along. And I think one could argue it makes it for a stronger,
experience.
But the way in which, you know, pragmatic circumstances sometimes alter artists' intentions, I thought was really interesting.
Well, there were complaints about the color of the rock, which is black granite. People were talking about that being a symbol of shame and dishonor. The term "a black gash of shame" was used.
Yes, absolutely.
Ronald Reagan, who was president at the time, he said it was a political statement of shame and dishonor, intent on perpetrating national humiliation, and therefore this whole thing was an implicit criticism of the war. I remember all of this. It was incredible. So there were additions made. A flagpole, for instance, was added.
Right. And, you know, initially, I'm glad you mentioned the flagpole, because that kind of gets lost in our discussions of the sculptures that were added later. The flagpole, well, all the additions initially, the flagpole and the statue of the three servicemen, they initially wanted to put it at the center of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. I mean, I shudder every time I think of what that would have done to the whole experience. But fortunately, J. Carter Brown, who was the director of the National Gallery at the time, convinced them that this was not a good idea. So getting back to the flagpole for a moment, which we don't talk about that much, but it was very important to the servicemen because they felt it affirmed what they were fighting for.
Right.
They were fighting in a patriotic way. And then one of the interesting things, too, that I didn't know was there until I was standing there, was there was a plaque on the ground that was added sometime later, 2004, as I recall, that says, in memory of the men and women who served in the Vietnam War and later died as a result of their service. So their name wouldn't be on the wall, right, because they survived the war. But afterwards, they're, you know, Agent Orange and all those poisonous substances did, in fact, kill quite a number of people.
Now, the statue of the three servicemen, which is not right there now.
Right.
But the people wanted it to be. It seemed like a very typical, and I don't mean to critique the artist, but it was just like one of those typical, you know, brave soldiers. And that's okay. But it would have sort of broken the sort of reverent, contemplative aspect of the war memorial, which now has become such an important place for Vietnam veterans to go.
Absolutely. Well, the three servicemen, which was done by Frederick Hart, who had also been part of one of the design teams that didn't win the competition. They had, you know, finished third. It's a competent, figurative, realistic sculpture, I think, based on something in a Washington National Cathedral, but that's not as important as the notion of the place of the figurative in our memorials. The commission, when they created the call for proposals, specifically decided that having something figurative was probably not a good idea, because then everybody would want to be represented, which is in fact what happened with the Vietnam Women's Memorial.
Right, exactly.
But I had a really interesting experience while I was standing there with the three servicemen and looking at the plaque on the ground. I was a young boy, I would guess to be about 8 or 9 years old, and he's standing next to the statue with his mom, and he's pointing across the field at Myelin's sculpture, and he says to his mother, look, there's the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. So I think that when people are there, if he's any example, and I believe he is, it's still Myelin's sculpture that's considered the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
Well, it's become, as you write in your book, a meeting place, a place for remembering, mourning, and personal healing. I mean, it's really become a very dynamic memorial.
Absolutely. And it's also become, from, you know, from a formal point of view, we don't have another model that has been as influential as that memorial. There's still, in the way that I was saying before about the 9/11 memorial, its influences are still being felt in terms of listing the dead, in terms of even materials, et cetera. So it has really resonated among the creative community in a formal way, as well as among so many people who are so moved when they go there. And in fact, it was the public, it's the audience for the memorial that first acted as if they were going to a cemetery. There was a Navy officer who dropped his dead brother's Purple Heart into the foundation trench. Nothing was there yet, but somehow he had a sense that symbolically he wanted to bury his brother there. I found that incredibly moving. And of course, since then, people have left hundreds of thousands of objects.
Well, yeah, I was going to talk about that next because, you know, you always wonder, you see people and you know people have been leaving flowers, obviously, but all sorts of objects. And they're all different kinds of objects. There's personal objects. There's things like medals. There's objects that maybe from their childhood, photographs. These are actually now organized and cared for.
They are, and I was fortunate enough to be able to visit the warehouse where they were stored at the time. I think they're still there, but I may be wrong about that. But anyway, as I kept thinking about them and I'm looking at them, and they began to kind of speak to me in a different way, because I began to think that people are constructing their personal memories, as
right.
Violet intended, in different ways. So to me, they fell into four categories. I don't know, since there are many more now, whether those would still pertain. But what I saw was relics of the deceased. So that would be clothing. There were a lot of uniforms hanging in lockers, in fact, in this warehouse, dog tags, things like that. And then there were things that seemed to be like gifts for the dead. This would occur especially on national holidays or birthdays. So like stuffed animals or cards or something called boo-boo bunnies. I didn't know what that was. It was evidently washcloths in the shape of bunnies that were popular in the Midwest, you know, to soothe boo-boos. And so I figured that had to be a mom or dad or somebody like that. Then there were objects that suggested to me sort of shared experiences, like a basketball. Maybe they played sports together. Cards, that seems obvious. Recreational drugs, marijuana, liquor. And then the fourth category, which I really didn't get a chance to, you know, really investigate in great detail, but it's something that I call documentation and commentary. So like journals, photo albums, flags, paintings. These, I think, are really, really incredibly interesting because people are making a commentary on their experience and their interpretation of this particular undeclared war.
And you write about how people behave at the war memorial versus the sculptures. I mean,
yes.
Especially to the women's Vietnam War. Women's Vietnam War memorial, which has four women in it. You talk about how guys were sort of posing with it. Kids were climbing on it. But as soon as you enter Maya Lin's designed, it's like you're at a cemetery.
Absolutely. People are quiet and respectful. And that has been my experience every time I've been there. And the one time, I'm not quite sure which holiday it was when I was there, but there was a Vietnam vet at one end of the memorial just encouraging people to be still. I began to relate it to kind of the experience that I had at Arlington National Cemetery,
right.
Or any cemetery where one is quiet and in a mournful state, or at the very least, a reflective state. There's some activity around the three servicemen, but around the Vietnam Women's Memorial, people, which is at a distance, it's not, you know, not in direct sight of Maya Lin's sculpture, There's three figures. One woman is cradling a soldier, looks a lot like a pietà. One is looking up in the air, and another one is looking off into space. And the three figures were titled by the sculptor Glenda Goodacre, Caring, Hope, and Despair.
Right.
So they're intended to be symbolic. But, you know, when I was there, there was some guy hanging off the sculpture. I mean, literally climbed on it, smoking a cigarette. One of his pals was taking a picture. And
great.
There were folks sitting around there drinking.
Wow. Well, that says more about what's happening around that area.
Yeah, right. I mean, we can't.
You know what, Harriet? We're going to run out of time. We have just a few minutes left. And I want to mention that an offshoot of this memorial were the traveling walls, where small replicas of the memorial go to different parts of the country.
Yes, they were half-size replicas. There was one behind the New York Public Library. Right in the, you know, in the center of the city around 42nd Street, between 5th and 6th Avenue, on the 6th Avenue side. And I was lucky that I was able to go see it. It's half size. You would never, you know, confuse it for the real thing. But people were behaving in the same way. They were quiet. They were respectful. Some people left things there as well.
We had so much more to talk about, and we've completely run out of time. My returning guest tonight is Harriet F. Senney. Tonight, we've been talking about her book, Memorials to Shattered Myths, Vietnam to 9/11. We have only been talking about the very first chapter in this book, and it just gets more fascinating as it goes along. Harriet, it's been a pleasure.
For me as well. Thanks so much for the invitation. Always great to chat.
I love it. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.